As I've said, this term I'm only doing this series of three, therefore, dealing with the three postulates that are given to us in the beginning of anthropogenesis. And last week we considered the first of these, the simultaneous evolution of seven human groups on seven different portions of our globe, and noted the way in which that may be understood. I won't review it because it's all there on the tape and what we dealt with last week. Today I want, therefore, to deal with the final two postulates. Not easy ones, particularly the third one is not an easy one. The second one is perhaps much easier. But it is out of the first one, really, this simultaneous evolution of seven human groups, that the, in one sense, leads us to see the validity of the second postulate. Now, one has to keep in mind that these three postulates are probably as far from orthodox science in terms of evolutionary theories being proposed, not simply the Darwinian theory, but the various ones that have been proposed since. They still are about as far from evolutionary theories as can be imagined. And while there are certain correlations, if I can put it that way, or correspondences between some of the concepts which were presented in the Secret Doctrine nearly 100 years ago with some areas of contemporary science, I would imagine that most biologists, with the possible exception of our good friend Rupert Sheldrake, would probably be horrified at the consideration of these propositions, and yet they are fundamental to the theosophical system, and indeed bear it out in terms of man's own evolution. So the second postulate is, you'll remember, the birth of the astral before the physical body, the former being a model for the latter. So we have here now a kind of repetition, if I can put it this way, of the process of emanation in a movement from within outwards, in accordance with a fundamental principle of the theosophical philosophy. But it is most important to realize how HPB used the term astral, because later literature has identified this, particularly what I call our middle period of literature, the Besant Leadbeater tradition, came to use the word astral, where it was used for that term, that principle, which really is better identified as the linga sharira. Now, there has always existed, and I suppose always will exist, within the theosophical movement, a kind of resistance to learning Sanskrit. And therefore, and of course, I certainly admire the work that both Dr. Besant and Mr. Leadbeater did in bringing many of the deeper teachings into a very simplified form. And that was a risky business, and they took that risk. And undoubtedly, if they were writing today, they would find another way of expressing it, because they had to write out of the context of their understandings, plus the language that was available to them. And this changes. We have, you may not realize it, but our language itself has changed in 100 years. It's very easy to see the changes that have occurred in 1,000 years. None of us are speaking Chaucerian English or Shakespearean English even. But even within 100 years, our language has changed. So it is, I think, within a context that one has to look at these things. And therefore, it seems to me that just as if one is going to study any particular science, one learns the language of that science, it is helpful to know at least some fundamental words in the Sanskrit, because it is the most philosophical language. English is a perfectly good medium of trade. It's a good language of commerce, and it probably is the lingua franca today in commerce. But it's not a very philosophical language. Sanskrit is fundamentally a language of philosophy. To some extent, Greek was also. I won't get into languages, that will get me too far away. But if we can see that what is being said here is that there is the birth of a model body before its densification. That's what's being said. Then you can forget about the word astral in HPB's sentence and the word physical. What we're talking about is that there is emanation from within outwards, and there is always a model before its densification. And this principle, when put that way, is perfectly acceptable to science, contemporary science, not only in terms of chemistry and physics, but also in terms of biology, that there is a model before its densification. Now, we've already referred, of course, to the basic teaching that this chain of globes, and again we have to be very careful, and that's why I gave you the E.L. Gardner diagram, because I think it comes a little bit closer to the way things are, if I can put it that way, than the sort of levels, as though you go from the physical up into something else. It is a matter in which they are all present here now in terms of consciousness. But when we consider, therefore, that this chain is the progeny of a previous chain known in the doctrine as the moon chain, because it said that our moon was the densest globe of that chain, then we recognize that the particular hierarchy which gave birth to humanity in terms of form, and this is what this second proposition is dealing with, form, the particular hierarchy which gave birth to humanity is known, you'll recall, as the lunar petries. Petri meaning, of course, father. Sometimes they are called the fathers, the moon gods in Shloka 13, or sometimes called the Varhashads, which is again an interesting term because it means that they sat near the fire. They did not participate in the fire, representative of Manas, but sat near to it. So the first human stage of existence on this earth globe, which is D in the series, you remember, often called globe D, occurred through the agency of these superior beings, superior in the sense that they preceded this particular life wave, but not necessarily superior in intellectual or spiritual development. So one has to be very careful in this. Who bequeath to our globe and to our humanity as a creative hierarchy the principle of the model body. I might just interpose here the fact that there are really two ways of studying anthropogenesis. There may be many ways, but there are simply two ways of approaching our subject. One is the subject of the evolution of humanity by means of the evolutionary development, which are called the root races, and that is through the rounds and the stages of development in each particular round. Or there is the study of the evolutionary development of the principles of the human constitution. And this is an interesting thing. One can study it in terms of the development of the principles, or one can study it in the terms of the development of the stages of consciousness in which those principles are awakened. Now, this is going to have a lot of bearing when we come to the third proposition, but it has bearing even here, because it is this group that, as it were, their gift to this particular life wave of humanity was a model body. HPB explains this in volume 2, page 88. The progenitors of man, called in India fathers, pitaris or pitris, are the creators of our bodies and lower principles. They are ourselves as the first personalities, and we are they. Primeval man would be the bone of their bone and the flesh of their flesh if they had body and flesh. As stated, they were lunar beings. That is, they belonged, therefore, to the previous chain, which is said in occult literature to be the moon chain, you see. So one of the points to be noted in this, they are ourselves as the first personalities. So not only did they bequeath this, but there is a tremendous economy of nature. Nothing is ever lost within a system. Within the ring pass knot established for a particular system. And therefore, they are we and we are they. Now this doesn't, do you see that, in other words, a kind of new incarnation in which now the principle that is known as the Linga Sharira, you see, I'm sure you're familiar with this term, which is simply the sheath or vehicle, which is a model, that's all it means. It's a kind of model. You have a template from which everything is therefore cut out. Now it's interesting that this is one doctrine that HPB hinted at in her very first work, Isis Unveiled. A lot of things were not mentioned in Isis that later came on in the secret doctrine, as you know. But this is one concept which she did introduce in Isis. In fact, in the very beginning of it, it's on page 38, if you take the Roman numerals, but it's in the area where the Roman numerals are. So it's XXXVIII, you know, in the first volume of Isis, where HPB says, the Petris are not the ancestors of the present living men, but those of the first humankind or Adamic race, that is, of which Adam was the prototype. The spirits of human races, which on the great scale of descending evolution preceded our races of men and were physically as well as spiritually far superior to our modern pygmies. In Manavadharma Shastra, they are called the lunar ancestors. I would like to suggest that, you see, in her reference to the Manavadharma Shastra, which is one of the great texts of Indian literature, the Shastras are texts dealing, indeed, by and large, with stories, very much like the Puranas in one sense, with allegorical stories that, even in saying that they're called the lunar ancestors, that there is a certain metaphorical sense rather than a literal sense. I'm one who's convinced that, and so I throw out some of my prejudices now and then, and this is one of them, that we have to be very careful on literalism. I think that we need to be alert to symbolic and metaphorical meanings in a lot of these instances. Certainly that was true in much of the Hindu literature, Indian literature, the Shastras, the Puranas, very much so. Now, Jeffrey Barborka points out a very significant fact in the Divine Plan, that these primordial astral or ethereal forms prevailed both in the animal and the human kingdoms, and that an entirely different constitution from the present physical vehicle then existed. And I think this is the point, you know. At the very early stage, the physical vehicle was not what we have today. We have to remember that. What was it like? Well, we're not exactly sure. Now, this is quite evident, of course, from HPB's statement that I've just quoted. And she clarifies this further in The Secret Doctrine, Volume 2, page 736. There's a whole section towards the end of Volume 2 in which, of course, she's dealing with science and in which she's brings out what was the science accepted of her day on the origin and evolution of the mammalia science and the esoteric phylogeny that, of course, now in one sense needs to be revised in terms of some of the biological findings today, as you know. But HPB there says, the forms of men and mammalia previous to the separation of the sexes, now that, remember, was an event which occurred, we're told, in the middle of the third root race some 18 million years ago, and it's also said that that event, the separation of the sexes, that that event marked the appearance of man as we know him. From that time onwards, the physical form was tending more and more to the physical form as we know it. But previous to that, she says, the forms of men and mammalia are woven out of astral matter and possess a structure utterly unlike that of the physical organisms which eat, drink, digest, etc., 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 she says. So both the form, not only was there a model body, but the form itself was woven, as she uses the term, out of this ethereal matter. And then I love this of HPB, because I suspect that many times in her writing, some of her own prejudices showed forth in the choice of words that she put in. And I'm sure that having the kind of physical body she had, which must have been a great trial to her on many occasions, a rather difficult vehicle, I think, you know, I suppose any of us who have traveled in India think about what it would have been like to have carried, you know, with voluminous Victorian skirts and black stockings and all the rest of it, and travel around in that country. Anyway, she puts then this interesting statement, the known physiological contrivances in organisms were almost entirely evolved subsequently to the incipient physicalization of the seven root types out of the astral. Now, let me pause there. There's more to the sentence, but the known physiological contrivances, which are, of course, the organs of digestion, assimilation, reproduction, all of that. These are the known physiological contrivances, as she calls them, were almost entirely evolved after this incipient physicalization of the seven root types, which she's talked about in the first fundamental postulate. You remember these seven human groups. And she says this happened during the midway halt between the two planes of existence. Now, what's that midway halt? When she speaks of that, the midway halt between two planes of existence, she's referring, as she indicates earlier in that same reference, to the stage where the astral prototypes, and she uses there again astral, but remember this is etheric, if you like, prototypes, definitely begin to pass into the physical. So there's a midway halt, you see. Now, I think this is very interesting because, in a sense, we can understand it by the one of the theories of evolution being advanced today by such people as Stephen Jay Gould, for example, who's one of the leading thinkers in the field, of jumps, that evolution does not just take a straight line. Gould is suggesting that it isn't just a straight line, but that it moves, and then there's a jump, and then it moves again. And what happens here is still not quite certain. And then there's another jump. It's a discontinuous. And I think that the term, in fact, that Gould has been using is non-equilibrium or discontinuous evolution, something of that sort. And in a sense, what is happening here is this midway halt, do you see? Now, when we studied cosmogenesis, you remember we spent a lot of time on what are known as the Laya centers. And these are, of course, between what we, if you want to see the planes in this way, the Laya center is, let us say that this is the astral, this is the etheric and the physical, you see. It's neither this nor that. There is, as it were, a point, because Laya, you remember, comes from the root verb li, to dissolve. There is a point where everything has dissolved and has not reappeared at the next stage or next level. It's a point of this, in one place HBB calls it the nirvana between planes, or between levels of consciousness. There is a nirvanic condition. Laya is in that sense. And consequently, at all of these stages, and this is most important for our present development, because very frequently when we look at our present development, we talk about a bridge now in the realm of manas, in the realm of mind, a bridge which we call antakarana, you remember. And so many people say, you know, this is the principle between higher and lower mind, if you like, or between the two ways in which manas functions. But what this means, anta means between, karana means causative. It's from the same root as karma, kri. And at this stage, at this early stage, the antakarana had to be built downwards, from above downwards. We are now building the antakarana upwards. And this is significant, do you see? So at the outset, because there is always a bridge, once the bridge is over, once you've crossed the bridge disappears, you see? And this is why it is said in the voice of the silence that the time will come that the antakarana will disappear. For our stage, it will disappear when manas is one again, united again. Just as the antakarana has disappeared now between the etheric and the physical. In any conscious way, we're not aware of it. But at that point, there is always a bridge. It's a leap across a chasm, do you see? And this is... I hope this is making sense, but I think is it? Well, if Betty says it is, then it's good. Thank you, Betty. Well, now, so this is this midway halt, as she says, where the prototypes definitely begin to pass into the physical. Now, more details on this entire process are given by HPB in this section to which I referred you in Volume 2. It's in part 3 of volume 2, pages 731 and the sequel to those, in a section 5, called Organic Evolution and Creative Centers. Now, we'll have to deal with this section, of course, in some detail when we take it up in our study of the shlokas. But a very interesting illustration of the transition which occurs from the etheric, or astral as HPB is calling it, to the physical, is supplied by HPB herself. And this is on page 737 of volume 2. She says, as to the reality of the descent into the physical, which culminated in physiological man and animal, we have a palpable testimony in the fact of the so-called spiritualistic materializations. It's a very interesting analogy that she's using. In all these instances, she says, that is, instances of materializations, a temporary emergence of the astral into the physical takes place. And then it is projected outwards. This is the, you know, the phenomena of the seance room, the spiritualistic seance room. The evolution of physiological man out of the astral races of early Lemurian age, that is, the early third race period, the Jurassic age of geology, is exactly paralleled by the materialization of spirits in the seance room. It's a marvelous illustration, you see. Now, this, I suggest, is one of the reasons why to do this is extremely dangerous. This is part of our past. And therefore, we are now established here, and the projection of this so-called ectoplasm and all the rest of it is to retreat into a primitive condition which can endanger the consciousness that is now operative at another level. Because the bridge itself, we've crossed that bridge. You don't have to keep recrossing bridges, you see, or hauling up the bridge and carrying it with you, you know, sort of thing. Well, this second postulate leads us also to consider the manner in which the various stages of evolutionary development on this globe proceeded through successive modes of procreation. The first stage, or first root race, therefore, as it's often called, but these are stages of development, is called the Chaya race. Because, you see, here coming in first is this very shadowy form, and Chaya simply means shadow or shadowy. And it's from the fact, therefore, you see, and she's already pointed this out, that the so-called men of that race were more shadowy than physical. You could sort of put your hands, you know, we could put our hands through each other. Sort of interesting, you see. Because, the, as she calls them, the physiological contrivances weren't there yet, you see. So we could just sort of, you know, embrace each other by sort of flowing into each other. Rather an interesting way, you know. You can remember what it was like to embrace, you know, somebody at that stage. We were all there, so you ought to be able to remember. And HBB quotes from an occult, the occult catechism, to give a commentary on this point. This is in volume 2, page 57. You note I always give you the references so you can look them up and see if I'm being correct or not. Your interpretation, of course, may be different from mine, which is fine, too. But she points this out. She says, it is from the material worlds that descend they who fashion physical man at the new Manvantara. They are inferior law spirits, possessed of a dual body, an astral within an ethereal form. They are the fashioners and creators of our body of illusion. Now, the body of illusion is, of course, the Linga Sharira, because it is shadowy. It is illusory in that sense, because you can sort of see through it, and, you know, yet it has shape. Now, when she says it is from the material worlds that they descend, we have to note that what's being referred to is the lunar or moon chain. Since from one point of view, and here is where it sometimes becomes difficult, that chain was actually more material than ours in the sense that, not that it was, because we're not talking about densification of, you know, tables and chairs and physical bodies, but in terms of the fact that it was less developed, it was much more, if you like, tamasic, it was much more inertial It was shadowy, yes, but it did not have the, what shall we say, the plasticity that we have come to associate with matter at this level. So in that sense, it was more material. So while the graduates of that chain are sometimes called the moon gods or lunar petries, from the fact that they had attained what may be thought of as a kind of godlike status on that chain, and they are us, don't forget, but had attained a kind of, for that chain, what we would call a godlike status, they are still the inferior laws or spirits as compared with the solar petries or gods of will who awaken the manasic principle. Now, of course, to comprehend this fully, one would have to review all the teaching that we've already taken up in regard to the creative hierarchies. And we will, of course, review that at a later time. Now, the body of illusion, then, which is provided by these lunar petries, who are both our fathers and ourselves, both superior in having gone before and inferior in not being able to awaken the mind, they're sitting only near the fire. They have not been sweetened by the fire, as the Agnishvata hierarchy has. This body of illusion provided by these beings, the model or etheric vehicle, will in due time become physicalized, a stage reached only at the midpoint of that third root race with the separation of the sexes. And these vehicles, both the model body and the physicalized form, which is, as HPB expresses it at one point, she says, concretized about the model, are, of course, subject to constant change and modification. They're not, then, the immortal part. And this is made very clear in the first stanza of this second set in Shloka 3. Said the Lord of the Shining Face, this is page 44 of volume 2, Shloka 3, so we're right close to the beginning, said the Lord of the Shining Face, I shall send thee a fire when thy work is commenced. Raise thy voice to other lokas. Apply to thy father, the Lord of the Lotus, for his sons. Thy people shall be under the rule of the fathers. Thy men shall be mortals. It's a beautiful statement, that shloka. Absolutely beautiful. The Lord of the Lotus, of course, the lotus is represented the moon. And so thy people, that is of this particular cycle, are under the rule of the fathers. And therefore thy men, that is the men of earth, are mortal. But I shall send thee a fire when thy work is commenced. A marvelous promise. You see, that we'll someday get warm. You know, on cold winter days, you can think of that. The entire shloka, of course, is a most interesting one, and of course is addressed to the earth, as Globe D said, the Lord of the Shining Faith. You see, the if you like, the solar logos, but the logoic principle to this particular globe, this particular structure on which the evolution of the life wave, the human life wave, is now to take place. And a far superior intelligence than here called the Lord of the Shining Face. So it is that the men of this globe, our present humanity, are under the rule of the lunar petries. And how true this is from time immemorial, really, you know, the influence of the moon. Our very word month, our very word table, you realize, in the Latin was mensa, which was that on which we ate, and came from the same verb as gave us the word month and lunar and so on. All of these words are cognate.
Mental.
No, not mental. That comes from another source. You have to watch. You have to be very careful. those of us who remember John Algio's series, and John, of course, one of the great scholars in linguistics and so on, points this out very clearly. Simply because words sound alike, they are not always cognate in the different languages. One has to be very clear about that. So you have to look at the origins and really understand their origins. But it's rather interesting that even the Latin form of the word table, you see, has to do with its lunar origin. That from which we eat is indeed the earth, you see, and we are therefore mortal. And under the rule there, so far as our lower principles are concerned, and hence they are mortal. Now, we can just note in passing, then, the final statements of that particular shloka, shloka 3, which is quite an interesting one, in order to understand more of the story. We'll be going into it in detail and spending a lot of time on it. The men of the Lord of Wisdom, which referred to Mercury, not the sons of Soma, that is the moon, are immortal. Cease thy complaints. Marvelous, you see. Cease thy complaints. Thy seven skins are yet on thee. Thou art not ready. Thy men are not ready. So, you see, all in good time, the events occur in sequence. Well, we can't explore the details of that shloka at this time. The story is such a fascinating one. But what is really important now is to gain a picture then of the general process. And that's been given to us in this second postulate, you see. The birth of the inner model before the formation of the outer physical sheath. Here too, I think we see a reflection of the entire cosmogonic process. Ashish points it out so very beautifully in Man, Son of Man, on pages 116 and 117. He deals with it. It's in Man, Son of Man. It really is a very beautiful manner in which he talks about the pattern-filled space of the Arupa universe, with the outbursting then comes within that. It begins to fill the present, begins to fill up with the divine imaginals, as he calls them. And therefore, from the archetypes, these images are born, and then their physicalization. The essential principle, of course, is that everything proceeds from within outwards. This is an essential principle. And indeed, we can see this repeated all the time. All of the oak is present in the acorn. All of it. What it will be, its pattern, is present. In volume 1, page 274, you remember, the universe is worked and guided from within outward. As above, so it is below. As in heaven, so on earth. And man, the microcosm and miniature copy of the macrocosm, is the living witness of this eternal, of this, to this universal law and to the mode of its action. We see that every external motion, act, gesture, whether voluntary or mechanical, organic or mental, is produced and preceded by internal feeling or emotion, will or volition, and thought or mind. So it is a universal law, and it must therefore be operative in anthropogenesis. In terms of man, and then we have the principle repeated again and again, and in terms of the shlokas, of the stanzas describing man's origins, we have shloka 12, the great Chohans, called the lords of the moon, of the airy bodies, bring forth men, men of your nature, give them their forms within. She, and that's nature or the earth itself, will build coverings without. And so this is what has happened. It makes such a magnificent story. And it fills in a lot of the gaps, I think, that science leaves unanswered, of course. Well, that's so much for the second postulate. And before we take up the final postulate then, since it's so close to having coffee, we'll give you a break, because the final postulate is one of the very, very difficult ones. And yet, I think perhaps some scientists are beginning to hint at it in a interesting theory that's being postulated in biology. So after the tea break, we'll come back to that. I want to take up now the final postulate in the set of three propositions, and there's quite a good deal on it, so I'll have to really make time. But it is a very important one, and probably there is no thesis that is presented in the secret doctrine that is more antithetical in its assertion to contemporary science or what science claims to know than this postulate. And even for the esoteric student, it's a very puzzling one, because it says simply that man in this round, which means the fourth round, preceded every mammalian, the anthropoids included, in the animal kingdom. Now, this is really quite a statement, isn't it? But on reflection, of course, if you really reflect on the occult story of man, there will come, I think, a clarification of the matter. Because two words are, of course, very important. First, as I've already emphasized, the phrase, in this round, which has to do with the fourth round. And second, the term mammalian, which refers to a mode of procreation. So one has to be very clear on that. The second point is, of course, explained by HPB in a later commentary to which I've already referred, that one in, which begins on page 734 of volume 2, The Origin and Evolution of the Mammalia, Science and the Esoteric Phylogeny. In that section, HPB states, this is page 736 of volume 2, bear in mind, please, that though the animals, mammalians included, have all been evolved after and partially from man's cast-off tissues, still, as a far lower being, the mammalian animal became placental and separated far earlier than man. Really profound statement. Now, the cast-off tissues could not be physical matter, but rather refer to astral or etheric substance, because you have to go back to the second that the etheric or the astral preceded the physical. You see, the form body was given first. So it's the cast-off tissues of that which were taken on by animal consciousness and provided the shadowy forms at the beginning of this round. In a footnote to the statement of the postulate itself, HPB refers to the esoteric meaning of the Genesis story, which has come, you know, to us as so much else in the Bible in a highly distorted form. But she refers to it. This is pages 1 and 2 of volume 2, right at the outset in setting forth this postulate. And she says, referring to Genesis 2, chapter 2, verse 19, Adam is formed in verse 7, and in verse 19 it is said, out of the ground the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every fowl of the air and brought them unto Adam to see what he would call them. So it is in the Bible that man, Adam, Adamic, the Adamic race, which is the first of this round, preceded the animals. It's there in the Bible. I'm sure this would come as a shock to many good Christian ministers, you see. So, as she says, thus man was created before the animals. For the animals mentioned in chapter 1, in which we had the order of the creative hierarchies, you see, in which, you know, the light was separated from the darkness and the firmament from this, that, and the other, and everything was created, you know, There we had the animals first and then man, didn't we? In the first chapter of Genesis. And she says there, the animals are the signs of the zodiac. That is to say, what she's simply saying is that they are the archetypes, not the prototype, but the archetypes of the animal kingdom as it will later evolve. So in that sense, the animal kingdom is prior to man in the archetypal creation. But in this round, even the Bible points out that the animals came after Adam, you see. Adam was there first. So she says, while the man, male and female, is not man, but the host of the Sephiroth. And that's in chapter 1, created he them, male and female created he them. This is the host of the Sephiroth. Forces or angels made in his, that is God's image and after his likeness. The Adam man is not made in that likeness, nor is it so asserted in the Bible. However, the second Adam is esoterically a septenary which represents seven men, or rather groups of men, the seven groups which were on this globe, D, simultaneously at the outset, you see. And she continues, for the first Adam, the Cadman, is the synthesis of the ten Sephiroth. Of these, the upper triad remains in the archetypal world as the future trinity, while the seven lower Sephiroth create the manifested material world, and this septenate is the second Adam. I'm still quoting HPB. And so she adds, Genesis and the mysteries upon which it was fabricated came from Egypt. The God of the first chapter of Genesis is the Logos, and the Lord God of the second chapter, the creative Elohim, the lower powers. Well, one can go, therefore, into all of that symbology, and it's very clear there. So the origin of man must be traced to divine beings, as already suggested in our exploration of the second postulate, and those divine beings, including the lunar Petries, gave man or provided man with the vehicles reaching downwards only to the etheric. In other words, they could not create a physical man, but only provide a copy of what they themselves had achieved. Nor could they create a physical man in the sense we know it, because the earth itself was not in a physical condition as we know it today. And so in her commentary on Shloka 24, HPB further elucidates this postulate concerning the prior appearance of man in this round. And this again is volume 2, pages 169 and 170. She says, as regards that other question of the priority of man to the animals in the order of evolution, the answer is as promptly given. If man is really the microcosm of the macrocosm, then the teaching has nothing so very impossible in it, and is but logical. For man becomes that macrocosm for the three lower kingdoms under him. Arguing from a physical standpoint, all the lower kingdoms save the mineral. This is interesting. All the lower kingdoms save the mineral, which, as she says, is light itself, crystallized and emetallized, from plants to the creatures which preceded the first mammalians, all have been consolidated in their physical structures by means of the cast-off dust of those minerals and the refuse of the human matter, whether from living or dead bodies on which they fed and which gave them their outer bodies. In his turn, man grew more physical by reabsorbing into his system that which he had given out, and which became transformed in the living animal crucibles through which it had passed, owing to nature's alchemical transmutations. Now that paragraph needs profound study, and we could spend, weeks on it, because everything is in there. But what we can call attention to, since we don't have weeks and we have a limited amount of time even this morning, what we must call attention to is that very remarkable article which I have mentioned on a number of occasions, which is in one of the collected writings, and I meant to look up which one of the volumes of the collected writings it is in. I think it's along about volume 6 or 7, but don't take me too exactly. But it is published in 5 years of Theosophy, and I borrowed Virginia's reissued copy because mine is the original edition, which is no longer in print, of course. And so I thought, well, I'd show you that there is an edition of 5 years of Theosophy put out by Theosophy Company, which has this in it. It's right at the end, page 531, and it's this marvelous article on transmigration of the life atoms, which I think all too few theosophical students know about, but everyone who's ever attended any of my classes knows about fully because I keep referring to it. And it is a most essential article because it gives you the whole esoteric basis for the concept, which is quite correct in its place of transmigration. And we say, oh, we don't believe in that. Well, HPB believed in it in its place. That is to say, not in terms of if you want to say, a causal level of incarnation into the physical, from the causal into the physical, through Kama and Linga Sharira and so on. That is a reincarnation, because there is not a fleshly vehicle, a carne, you know, as flesh. Here, there is consciousness, yes, which takes on flesh. But at this level, in a horizontal level, as it were, there is indeed transmigration. Reincarnation operates here, between these two, in a vertical level. At this level, there is another horizontal process, which is metempsychosis. And at this level to Atma, there is another horizontal process, which is, I suggest, a process similar to transmigration, which I have often, what have I called it? I've called it by a variety of names, but it is indeed an alchemical process, and here again, at this level, where there is enlightenment, there is no space-time, and therefore no process, as it were, so that there is always this forming of a cross. There is both a vertical and a horizontal development. And what HPB is talking about at this point is very simply a process which at the physical level is indeed a process of alchemical transmutation, as she here calls it. And the cast-off dust, or the refuse of the human matter, refers to the life atoms, which do transmigrate. Another reason for our responsibility in how we treat our physical bodies. Because all the time there is an interchange with the earth and all of its creatures. Animal, plant forms, you see, constantly going on. And if the physical atomic structure, which we are all the time throwing off, and which is visible to the clairvoyant investigator, is deadened by the kind of life in which one is eating the coarsest of meats, you know, living on dead matter himself, you see, and drinking, smoking, all the rest of it, that is what is being thrown off at the physical level, just as much as angry thoughts and feelings of anger and hatred and thoughts of cruelty and so on are being the refuse of the atomic matter at our inner vehicles. This is being absorbed. And we are, in other words, we are a kind of alchemical retort. And this is what, of course, people like Paracelsus knew. They were not dabbling in laboratories, or laboratories, if you prefer, for my English-speaking friends. They were not dabbling in external things. They were using those as symbols of a true alchemical process, which HPB refers to, owing to nature's alchemical transmutations. So that whatever comes into our very physical vehicle, we have a responsibility to transform. And to me, this is the most logical argument for vegetarianism that one could ever bring up, you see. Because it is so logical. What are we exuding from the very pores of our being? You know. So, I know it. Yeah. Well, you know, this is it. And this cast-off dust does refer to the life atoms, as HPB calls them in this article, the transmigration of life atoms. I think everyone should read it. And we can note a footnote on page 225 of volume 1. Occultism, which discerns a life in every atom and molecule, whether in a mineral or human body, in air, fire, or water, affirms that our whole body is built of such lives, the smallest bacteria under the microscope being to them in comparative size like an elephant to the tiniest infusoria. And I always think of that marvelous science program that was on TV a few years ago, which showed, you know, the creatures that live in our eyebrows and so on. I mean, they're dinosaurs crawling around in our eyebrows under a microscope, you know. And on the scale, I mean, no wonder our heads itch now and then and so on. I mean, there are these things crawling around us which under high magnification look like elephants and dinosaurs tramping through your eyebrows. Well, I can refer you to that entire section of Volume 1 in which this footnote appears. It's a section we've studied in some detail, of course, in discussing Shloka 2 of Volume 7 of the first set of stanzas, so we don't need to go into it again. But it can be helpful to review that, particularly pages 224 and 225 of Volume 1. So the subject, of course, that we're considering is further clarified by a quotation which HPB gives us on page 250 of Volume 1 from the Occult Catechism. Every visible thing in this universe was built by such lives, from conscious and divine primordial man down to the unconscious agents that construct matter. From the one life, formless and uncreate, proceeds the universe of lives. There is nothing anywhere that isn't alive. And in the economy of nature, it is all being reused. And it, because man is indeed the model as the heavenly man, it all passes through us. And what are we doing with it? You know, sending it out as unconscious as it came in. So this third postulate concerning anthropogenesis is very firmly grounded in the occult doctrine that life is present in every atom, and that not a single atom is ever lost. Energy, if you like, rather than atom today. But there's a further and very important point that must be noted, and this, of course, concerns what we can call the archetype, which overshadows this particular planetary chain, and more particularly the fourth round. And this, again, is clearly set forth by HPB in the second volume. But we have to keep in mind again in this connection that at the beginning of this round, what we may call the early developmental stages, the first two root races, if you prefer, and into the middle period of the third, the condition of the globe was very different from what it is today. And hence, the stage of evolutionary development of its beings was also completely different. And this earlier condition is referred to when we continue the quotation to which I've referred earlier in Volume 2, page 170. HPB says, there were animals in those days of which our modern naturalists have never dreamed, and the stronger became physical, material man, the giants of those times, the more powerful were his emanations. Of course. Once that androgyne humanity separated into sexes, transformed by nature into child-bearing engines, love HPB's words, it ceased to procreate its like through drops of vital energy oozing out of the body. And that, of course, is a reference to the mode of procreation during the second stage of the evolutionary development. Yes, which is a mode known as the sweat-born, you see. And so she says, but while man was still ignorant of his procreative powers on the human plane, all this vital energy, scattered far and wide from him, was used by nature for the production of the first mammal-animal forms. We are responsible for mosquitoes. Simply the refuse of our own bodies when we didn't know any better, you see. So there we are. Karma comes back and stings you. The law operates. Well, then comes the really significant statement that sets forth again one of the very essential principles of the esoteric philosophy. Evolution is an eternal cycle of becoming, and nature never leaves an atom unused. Moreover, from the beginning of the round, all in nature tends to become man. All the impulses of the dual centripetal and centrifugal force are directed towards one point, man. Man is the alpha and omega of objective creation. I remember one time asking Geoffrey Hodgson, for example, why it seemed that the Davic forces, which he saw and which, you know, he attempted to hold through the artist working with him, although I think in Geoffrey's work one gets this feeling of the sweep, the flow, that they are fluidic, they are not stable forms as we are. And Geoffrey commented that it is really because of this prototype which is set there for everything in nature tends to become man. Here is the archetype, as it were. And so all intelligence in this round, remember, tends therefore to take on some similitude to that form. And so we have the archetype, as I say, for this round, which, of course, has been spoken of before as the heavenly man. It may also be called the anthropos. And I would like to, for the moment, call it the anthropos because it's interesting to note that some scientists today are postulating what is, in describing cosmological origins, they are postulating what is known as the anthropic principle. Some very interesting developments. The theory is based, incidentally, on quantum theory, and it's highly technical, and so it would be difficult to explain even if I were capable of doing it. But Dr. John Wheeler, who is, of course, the very well-known physicist at the University of Texas, has extrapolated from it a metaphysical position, which not all of his colleagues are willing to go along with, but he at least is willing to stick out his neck, a metaphysical position which is of very special interest to us. Of course, some have suggested that when he crosses this line into metaphysics, not many scientists are prepared to follow him. But be that as it may, the anthropic principle, which a number of scientists are willing to at least entertain in discussing cosmology, states that in essence, this is its statement, simply, the universe is as it is because only in such a universe can there be an observer to observe it? This is what's basic to the anthropic principle. And if this has led Dr. Wheeler to postulate that the observer is therefore as essential to the creation of the universe as the universe is to the creation of the observer. A remarkable metaphysical statement. The observer is as essential to the creation of the universe is to the creation of the observer. But the anthropic principle simply says that the universe is as it is in order that there can be an observer. And any change would eliminate an observer, but there has to be an observer. It's a very interesting concept. In other words, you see, Dr. Wheeler is asking quite seriously whether any universe could come into being at all unless it were guaranteed to produce life, consciousness, and observership, and I quote, somewhere and for some little length of time in its history to be. Quite an amazing statement. Well, this view presented in the occult doctrine, I think, should not make us feel superior in any way, but rather point towards what I feel is our essential responsibility, the unique position that we occupy in the entire cosmic scheme. Because it must always be kept in mind, too, that while we are the heirs of preceding creative hierarchies who have provided a prototype for physicalization, who have awakened the monastic principle which was there from the beginning, but have given it activity by incarnating and using it, therefore, the great Manasaputras, we, in our own right, our humanity is a creative hierarchy, and we have as serious and grave a responsibility to those hierarchies which will succeed us as did the Barashads and Agnashvata hierarchies to be sure they achieved something to give it to us, as it were, you see. And yet, we are they. We are our own past and our own future. So, men may have grown tall with pride, but we cannot deny our unity with all life, and consequently, our duty toward all that struggles upwards towards the light. We see all about us today the forgetfulness of that one essential truth, although fortunately many are coming, I think, to a realization of the nature of human responsibility, both to the globe that we occupy and to all other occupants on this fragile sphere of great beauty. The essential teaching, then, on which anthropogenesis is based, states simply that all forms, from atoms to men and on to galaxies, are essentially similar in structure, following one universal pattern. All are integrations of differing grades of energy around centers of consciousness. But for man, the story is unique, and yet it is the man pattern that provides the ideal for this round. Truly a mystery, for man is the matrix, then, of that universal mystery in which everything that is a mirror image of the one universal reality. Slice it how you will, the whole is present in every part. And perhaps nowhere has this process been stated more beautifully than by Ashish in Man the Son of Man. We have been raised to self-conscious being. The divine powers of the universe have thrust up from below, building up form after form as vehicles of their living consciousness. As each grade of form is prepared, it is seized upon and entered by the next higher level of conscious power, and again built up to become the vehicle for the next, until at last man stands with his feet on the earth and his head in the heavens, looking out upon the forms from which his form is made, a vessel for the flame of divine mind, the microcosmic image of the divine man. It's true, then, that in the Anthropos, the story of the cosmos is only the story of ourselves, and the story of ourselves is the story of the cosmos. There are many ways to look at this. The stanzas, of course, give us the most magnificent metaphors of this one essential truth, the one divine being, the eternal immortal, the ultimate, pours itself out into existent form. Man, for this round, at this time, here, now, is the cup which has received the final and most precious drop of living water, the self-nature of the one self-becoming. We are the measure and the significance of all existent things. We are the torch-bearer and the hope of all future worlds. We're still writing the story, of course, and there's a story told by the rabbis in the Midrashic tradition of Judaism that I have always loved. In the Midrash, it is written, Isaac asked the Eternal, King of the world, when thou didst make the light, thou didst say in thy Torah that the light was good. When thou didst make the extent of the firmament and the extent of the earth, thou didst say in thy Torah that they were good. But when thou hadst made man in thine image, thou didst not say in thy Torah that man was good. Wherefore, O Lord? And God answered Isaac, Because man I have not yet perfected, and because through the Torah man is to perfect himself and to perfect the world. Well, what is the Torah, but by which we have not only the opportunity but the capacity and even the responsibility then to perfect ourselves and the world? The Torah, of course, in that tradition, the Midrashic tradition, is not simply the first five books of the Old Testament. It's the total body of teaching concerning the principles of human conduct, the one essential ethic that flows from the great principle of one life, the truth concerning our essential nature and ultimate purpose. To use a term with which I suppose theosophists feel more familiar, it is dharma. Because man I have not yet perfected, and because through dharma man is to perfect himself and to perfect the world. And that is the teaching on which the entire secret doctrine is based and towards which it points. To know that we live, and to live what we know, that by our knowing and our living, we advance the structure and the consciousness of the entire universe itself. That is what's being said to us. It's tremendous. So in all of the multiplicity of details of the evolutionary cycles, this is the essential teaching. And it's there in these marvelous three fundamental propositions that are given to us, which mirror, in one sense, the three original propositions, because we are the cosmos. The cosmos is in us. And everything, therefore, must, either is, will, or was, man, the human stage, because the entire universe is founded on intelligence, consciousness. And we, becoming self-conscious, in this round, the most critical of all rounds, in probably the most critical of all systems, in this most critical of all incarnations, I think, the 20th century incarnation, when this was made public, but is still secret from those who have not or will not open their eyes to see one essential truth, everything is there. It's given to us. But what we do with it is up to us.
Well, so much for that. Any comments?
Some scientists seem to think that man is not only the highest form in this solar system, but in the galaxy and in all other galaxies. There's nothing. Man is the only, is the highest form of intelligence.
Yes.
Even the adepts, even the Buddha, assumes human form. So it depends on what one means. And that's why I say one can look at the whole story of anthropogenesis, either from the point of view of the developmental stages in which there is the awakening of consciousness at level after level, or one can look at it from the point of view of within this realm, the manner in which the structures are developed and inwardly awakened. And what I would object to in many scientists saying that, of course, is that it is our particular level of consciousness. The form as an arc, and yet the form is also undergoing change, you know. And it has. We know that. I mean, there are studies on the form side, of course. But the form follows consciousness. But the archetypal pattern is there, yes. So essentially what they're saying, I would agree with. I don't agree with their interpretation of what they're saying. I don't agree with the way they mean it always.
Virginia, do you have your hand up? John?
There's been a question on and off about consciousness and whether or not consciousness evolves. And is there an evolution of consciousness per se?
Often the term has been used, you see, evolution means to roll, you know, is to roll. Revolution is to roll around, to roll again in the same pattern. Evolution is, it is a cyclical process, is all that's being referred to. Many people prefer, therefore, the term unfoldment. There certainly is a movement. Consciousness is rooted in movement, rooted in motion. The Sankhya philosophy, of course, suggests, and in this, I think, there is a very close correlation with the theosophical view in the Sankhya philosophy that mind, for example, manas, arises from the interaction between rajas and tamas, the gunas present in substance or matter. And I like to use substance because it's throughout the whole system. It's qualities present in the way in which energy works, if you like. That therefore it is a movement which is constantly present. Motion is primary in the universe, indeed, says HPB. A movement which goes from unconsciousness to consciousness, you see. We do not know. What are the boundaries of our consciousness? What are the boundaries of our knowing? Who can set the boundaries of our knowing? As you probably know, in the last century, I've forgotten which of the great scientists it was of the last century, or great thinkers of the last century, made the definite pronouncement that all human knowledge had now been achieved, that there was nothing further to be known. This, of course, was before the birth of Einstein and Niels Bohr and, you know, all Rutherford and Clark Maxwell and all the others who have given us the concepts that have developed in this century. But this was said in the last century, about the middle of the last century. Everything that can be known is now known. We've found it all out, you see. And it was said very honestly, and said by a great person, whose name I can't remember, shows how great he was, but anyway. So does consciousness evolve? What does one mean by evolve? That it is in motion, yes. That it is constantly expanding the boundaries of knowing, quite obviously is true. It has to be. Yes, so, yes, yes. And this, I think, are the root races, simply developmental stages of consciousness. So, but if you prefer the term unfoldment, if you prefer the term of movement towards greater consciousness, rather than evolution, and keep the term, there are some, and some theosophical students prefer to keep the term evolution for the structure
and unfoldment for the consciousness utilizing the structure.
What about the principles?
Yes, the principles are all present from the beginning, but in latency.
Well, wouldn't the principles then exist in what would you call the archetypal field, which is consciousness, which is in relationship to the reflective field, which is matter,
mm-hmm.
in between is life? Because in the secret doctrine shows spirit and matter, and in between is life, right?
Mm-hmm.
Spirit or consciousness,
mm-hmm.
and life.
Well, but she says spirit is matter, and matter is spirit. And certainly I think we have to see this. But there is the dynamism which moves them, which is, of course,
doesn't
the energy.
Life in one illustration.
Yes, that's true. Yes.
You know,
yes.
And
that's right.
And
matter. Yes. And so. Matter or structure. I don't like the term matter because I think it's so misunderstood, really. But structure follows on consciousness. And this is certainly always that, in other words, function, in one sense, function precedes structure. We see this even in the development of the embryo of a chicken. It is very well known that in the development of the embryo of the chicken, the eye is developed. Now, what earthly use is there for an eye in the embryo of the chicken before it's in the daylight? Because the function is already there before it, the structure follows on. The structure is present so that it may utilize it in terms of its usefulness when it is out of the egg.
This is going back again to this matter of the unfoldment of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere in our theosophical literature, I have come across the concept that we come into manifestation as simply undifferentiated spirit.
Mm-hmm.
By the time the evolution, all of these developmental stages and everything has been gone through, we have achieved total consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And the time that H.P.B. speaks of as the day be with us,
mm-hmm.
is the day when there's no separate thing left to be conscious of, because
that's right.
We are all conscious.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that would be the purpose of every evolutionary
I think so, yes. It seems to me that's what's being said.
To become conscious.
Yes. Yes. And we can't set the boundaries on that. Janet?
You have said that everything evolves in this scheme through man.
Mm-hmm.
At what stage does the David kingdom come through man?
At some, because again, I know that this is one of the conundrums or the paradoxes which has been pointed out, you see, that some of our later leaders, writers, have suggested that the devas are a separate stream. It seems to me that this has oversimplified an essential truth, that there is, at this particular period, a seemingly separate stream. But if the universe, if the fundamental premise of the secret doctrine is accepted, which was certainly accepted by our later writers even, that intelligence or consciousness underlies the entire system, that is, that the emergence of the system is through Mahat, universal consciousness or universal mind, then every part of it must at some point or other participate in, and indeed must be a focal point, a foci of consciousness. Now, at various stages, one can, as it were, block off stages and say, at this stage, this particular manner of expressing consciousness does not hit this particular manner of expressing consciousness. But that it expresses consciousness cannot be denied.